Hi, I'm Mike Kozer, and welcome to the Lost Ballparks podcast. Before we get started, I just want to take a second and thank our Patreon members, those who are supporting Lost Ballparks monthly. Thank you so much for your support. Without it, this podcast would not be possible, and we certainly wouldn't be able to bring it to you commercial-free. So thank you, Patreon members, for supporting the Lost Ballparks podcast. If you have been enjoying the podcast and would like to see it continue, we would love to have your support as well. Go to lostballparks.com and click on our Patreon page to sign up. For being a monthly supporter, there are all kinds of benefits. An exclusive Lost Ballparks t-shirt for our clubhouse members. We've got Lost Ballparks stickers. You'll receive every single episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast a week early. There is exclusive behind-the-scenes footage, exclusive videos, and a whole lot more that you'll have access to for being a Patreon member. So when you get a second, go to lostballparks.com and click on our Patreon page. And now, this month's episode.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twilight doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The Effingham Shaver Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And there should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from Sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. So pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold shaver or two throughout the evening.
Steve Vucinich, who retired in 2021, spent 54 years with the Oakland A's, more than any other employee, Connie Mack included, in the team's history. A peanut vendor, a ball boy, and eventually the clubhouse manager, the much-beloved member of the Athletics, was inducted into the Oakland A's Hall of Fame in 2022. He was a part of the team for seven different decades and undoubtedly has some great stories to tell. Steve Vucinich.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Vucinich, I think it's safe to say that regarding the Oakland Coliseum, no one has spent more time there in its entire history than you. It opened in 1966, just a couple of miles from where you grew up in the foothills nearby. And at that point, how old were you?
15. Oh, it's six. I would have been 14. I'm sorry.
So you get a job selling peanuts at Raiders games the year the Coliseum opens.
That's correct.
2 years later, when the A's relocated to Oakland from Kansas City, you started to sell peanuts at their games. That lasted for about four games.
Actually, it was two.
Two.
And then the third day I didn't do that. I went down and talked to the then equipment manager and about getting the job because I knew the other guys had one other guy had quit because he was playing ball and
like a position for a ball boy or something.
Exactly. As a coincidence, what it was when they came out, they needed to hire some bat boys, ball boys, clubhouse attendants. So the people that came from Kansas City didn't know anybody in Oakland, so they called Oakland schools and one of the administrators there talked to an AD at Oakland High School and he recommended a few kids, and they took a couple that had written letters and applied. And so in a mixture of about five or six kids that are interactive bat boys, ball boys, clubhouse attendants, one of them quit because he was a top flight player and couldn't do the work and play ball at the same time. He eventually got drafted but never made the major league. So they told me one of them had quit. And I knew about four of the five kids through different ways. I'd refereed with one, umpired with one, gone to school with one, actually coached one in grammar school. So they had all told me, because I was hanging around, just being a, not real pain, but just hanging around like some kids do. And
yeah,
I went down and talked to I was told that the equipment manager is a guy named Al Zeke, who had moved out from Kansas City with the A's. So I went down to talk to him, told him I knew the area, I knew the stadium, and I'd like to be considered for the job. And Joe DiMaggio was standing there, and he was one of the coaches at that time. It's the only other big league uniform he ever wore. And he said, "Hey, kid, what school you go to?" I said, "I go to St. Joe's in Alameda." He goes, "Hey, he's a Catholic. You better hire him, Al." I really think I would have got the job anyway, but it makes for a good story, and it's a true story.
Yeah, I'm guessing there are not many people who can say that the Yankee Clipper was the one who was responsible for their start in Major League Baseball.
I gotta think I might have been the only one.
And that photograph that you had in your office at the Coliseum of you and DiMaggio, both sitting in the dugout in full A's uniform, What a great memory, I'm sure, for you.
It is. It's my prize one. I've got that one there, and then I've got another one that's somewhere in my archives that's signed by him, the same exact photo. But it gathered the most attention of all the different photos and collages that I had in my office for many years.
As an Oakland A's ball boy, you would have interacted with Harvey. Harvey made the move from Kansas City to Oakland with the rest of the team in 68. Harvey was a mechanical rabbit that was situated underground behind home plate at the Coliseum. So when the umpire wanted a ball, he would rise up with a tray of baseballs in hand, ready for the umpire to collect what he needed.
That wasn't installed till probably midway through that first year, 1968. And I did the actual ball boy and bat boys, they had the control for Harvey down by the dugout. And it was this big lever, and it sounded like a locomotive's train. And then the rabbit would come up. Part of the problem with that was it took a while. And in this day and age, you wouldn't have been able to do that except in between innings with the pitch clocks and things. But it took a while for it to pop up, and the umpires could reach over there and grab the balls, and he'd hit the lever again and it'd disappear. There was also a little thing that home plate that was installed at the same time, another thing that Charlie Finley had in Kansas City called little blowhard. And it was a little thing that popped up in the middle of the plate. The umpire controlled it by a foot lever, and it would clean off the plate so the umpire didn't have to back off. But that only lasted that season and didn't work right, and football was still at the Coliseum, and there were some problems there, so they never used it after that first year. But little Harvey survived a few years.
A's owner Charlie Finley was inventive. I mean, a little crazy. He was on Johnny Carson in 1976 talking about how he believed Major League Baseball should adopt an orange ball.
Now, if you have a color television set, this is a bright orange baseball. And of course, in baseball, the baseballs have been white ever since baseball came into being, and you would like to change that.
I sure would. With an alert orange baseball, number one, you got to think about the fans. This right. will enable the fans to follow the flight of the ball much easier than a white ball. Right. And number two, the hitters, they can see that ball coming out of that pitcher's white uniform an awful lot easier.
In addition to being a champion for orange baseballs, he had a mule, Charlie O, that served as the team's mascot in both Kansas City and Oakland. And this mule even had his own theme song.
Charlie O, the mule. Charlie O, the mule. Kansas City's pride and joy. Charlie O, the mule.
The mule had a huge presence, not just in Kansas City, but when the team moved in 68, also in Oakland.
Yeah, and he was set up at Skyline Stables, which was in the Oakland Hills, and there were other horses and things out there. And everybody knew who it was as he's going down the streets of Oakland, because the trailer was heavily decorated for Charlie O and the Oakland A's, and so was the station wagon that pulled them. He'd make appearances before the games, and there's some great stories back in the Kansas City days of Hawk Harrelson and Dick Green riding the mule and almost falling off and getting hurt.
For the younger folks who listen to the podcast, your perspective of the Coliseum, what you know today of the Coliseum, may be a colossal concrete structure that ran its course in Oakland. But in 68, there's no Mount Davis, the 20,000 seats in the outfield that were added in 1995. 68, there's a beautiful view, pretty wide open, foul pole to foul pole.
That's correct. There were bleachers there, and then there was part of the cement structure above that, and it had ivy on there. It was well decorated, and it was very pleasing. And then you could, from the second and or third deck, you could see the Oakland Hills. And there was a lot of talk that after the Raiders returned in 95 and they built what was referred to as a Mount Davis structure, and you couldn't see the hills. Well, truth of the matter is, nobody ever came to the ballpark to look at the hills.
Right.
But it was a nice sight at the time.
So the 1970s marked the era of the swinging A's.
Call them what you want, from their owner on down, loose, wacky, a very colorful team with their mod hairstyle.
What a team. Joe Rudy, Raleigh Fingers, Reggie Jackson, Vita Blue, Sal Bando, Catfish, Gene Tennis, Bert Campanaris. And then as clubhouse manager, you are the caretaker of those classic unis, the white jerseys, the white pants, the stripes around the sleeves and the waistband. Voos, that was one of the great uniforms of all time.
Yeah, Charlie was very innovative. The year before, the Braves actually came out with a blue top and wore white pants. And then Charlie decided, hey, well, I don't want to go with this double knit that's even brighter and the pants are whiter. And we wore white and white on the second and third day, or white on Sunday's games. and we wore white and gold the first game of the series, white and green the second and or third, and then obviously on Sundays all white. And it was kind of a first in baseball to have that many different uniforms. Before, everybody was just white and gray. There was no alternate jerseys or anything.
At 72, the team looks great, plays even better, makes it to the World Series to face off against Johnny Bench and the Big Red Machine.
A record crowd of almost 53,000 jams into Cincinnati's Riverfront Stadium for the World Series opener.
What stands out to me about 72 was catcher Gene Tennis for the A's had 5 home runs during the regular season, but in the World Series, he became the first player to hit 2 home runs in his first 2 World Series at bats.
There's a long drive deep down the left field line. That's going. Gene Tennis has hit his second home run in this World Series game. He is not a home run hitter.
Hits another home run in Game 4, one more in Game 5, and then before Game 6, security finds a man at Riverfront with a revolver who has threatened to shoot Tennis if he hits another home run. Do you remember that? Where were you, and did you have to coordinate at all with the FBI to help protect him?
We knew nothing about that. I think Gene Tennis was told about it. He was told to not even tell his teammates. And I don't know if maybe he told his best friend Sal Bando or not, but we knew nothing about it, and it wasn't disclosed till a little bit after the World Series was completed. Things like that were unheard of at that time. I mean, nobody carried guns and nobody was threatening people like that. I think Hank Aaron probably had some threats later on had been approached by Babe Ruth records. But that was totally, we didn't know a thing about it.
Were you at Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati for Game 7 of that 72 series?
Yes, I was. You know what happened that day was getting ready to take batting practice, and it just started to sprinkle, and the ground crew said they had to cover the field, so we didn't get to hit. And it was obviously a home field advantage they thought they were going to have because there were no indoor batting cages in those days, so our guys had no chance of swinging at all pregame, and the Reds ground crew said they had to cover the field. Well, there was no infield then. It was just the infield cutouts at the bases and around home plate, but they thought it was going to rain heavier, I guess, and we're told to cover the field and not let the A's hit and take batting practice.
And quite frankly, it has slacked off raining, and the umbrellas, keep your fingers crossed, have come down here at Riverfront Stadium.
And then Raleigh Fingers comes in and shuts down the Reds in the ninth. It's such a huge moment.
Last of the ninth, 3-2 Oakland. There's a fly ball hit in the deep left center. Joe Rudy there. Oakland has won the 1972 World Series.
I tell you what, I refer to that as the hairs versus squares. I, too, at that time had like shoulder length hair and was just 20 years old. And we had the long hairs, the beards, the mustaches, and the Reds were Johnny Straight Arrow. They couldn't even put stripes on their shoes if they were wearing Adidas and things.
In 73, the A's get off to a slow start, and Alabama football coach Bear Bryant is brought in to give the Oakland A's kind of a pep talk of sorts to kind of get the team back on track. Was that at the Coliseum? Were you there that day?
No, that was in Chicago, and I was not there. And Charlie Finley was friends with Bear Bryant because of the Alabama roots, and just had, I don't know if Bear was in town for any other reason or it was a special trip in just to talk to us. And I think it was more of a speech. We often have guest speakers like that, probably more predominantly in spring training. Tony La Russa was big on that. It wasn't really for a pep talk, but if you go on a winning streak after that, I guess we can refer to it as a pep talk, and it was successful.
They make it to the World Series, face off against the Mets.
And just a gorgeous day here in Oakland, California. A bright, sunshiny afternoon, temperature in the 70s, and a slight breeze blowing out from home plate to center field.
And this time, the deciding Game 7 was played at the Coliseum. I mean, you grew up a couple miles from the Coliseum. So here's Game 7 of the 73 World Series, and of course, you're there for that final out.
The Oakland A's have won their second consecutive World Series championship. The first time that's been done since the Yankees of 62-63.
Yeah, that was exciting because we split those first two games in Oakland, and that's a game where Mike Andrews supposedly made 2 errors, but it was a bad call by an umpire on the second one. It wasn't his fault, and they go through all that, and then we go to New York. And Charlie Finley is mad at the players because they wore a number 17 in honor of Andrews made out of tape in the workout on the off day before game 3.
Yeah, for those who don't remember, Mike Andrews supposedly makes the 2 errors in the game and Charlie Finley cuts him.
That's correct. We go to New York without Andrews. And on Monday we have a workout. get in there late Sunday night, give a workout Monday late afternoon, and the players hear about all that. They'd heard about it on the plane, but didn't know all the extent of everything. So Manny Trio's there as a backup, and you often carry a couple extra players in those days just in case somebody got hurt in there. That way they could be replaced immediately on the roster. But they all wore number 17 made out of white trainer's tapes on their jerseys, and Charlie Finley was mad at that. So when he distributed the tickets to the players' wives, he put them all up on the top deck and had all his friends from Chicago and Gary, Indiana, LaPorte, Indiana, and Birmingham, Michigan, that had come in, and they all got the better seats on the first deck. And the players' wives complained, and the players were upset. And so the next day, they had switched out the tickets. The players' wives got better seats down in the first deck. I don't think Charlie Finley's friends or some of his other relatives complained because they were probably just happy to be there.
And Mike Andrews, who was released unceremoniously cut from the Oakland A's World Series roster, is added back to the team.
That's correct. So we get a hold of Mike Andrews, and he comes in for games 4, 5, 6, 7. And I think he pinch hits in game 4 and gets a standing ovation from the Mets fans.
And Andrews gets a standing ovation as he goes back to the dugout. 54,800-plus stand here at Chase Stadium to give Mike Andrews a standing ovation.
The only two people who were sitting down were Charlie Finley and his wife.
I think you're absolutely right. I remember the cameras panned to them.
By 1974, you're promoted to visiting clubhouse manager. And at that point, how much are you making a month?
$300 a month. During the offseason, I had to collect unemployment or work somewhere else. And it was pretty standard in baseball at that time. And it wasn't just a Charlie Finley thing. It was, I mean, the Bushes did the same things. The Griffiths in Minnesota, things like that. So the visiting clubhouse position was not full-time in those days.
In 74, your first year as visiting clubhouse manager, the A's make their third consecutive World Series. And this time you're, as we said, in the visiting team clubhouse when the A's take Game 5 from the Dodgers.
One out away from the championship by the Oakland A's. Fingers deals a comebacker. Fingers has it and throws the first.
Obviously, you're a member of the Oakland A's. You're ecstatic because your team wins. But do you have to hide your emotion because you're running the other team's clubhouse?
Absolutely. And that's a very common thing through the season, too. The Dodgers gotten beat all three games in Oakland. The bags were packed anyway because they're going to return to L.A. after Game 5. But you're right. After celebrating with them in 72 and 73 and all of a sudden have to suck it in and be a little quiet with the Dodgers going to pack up and leave. And I got to be there to help with their equipment and get it up to the equipment truck, which goes to the airplane. But yeah, it was tough to do that. And it's so funny because years later, I was traveling with the club and I was still on the visitor side. And I'll never forget this. Joe Torre, he came to me because he was doing the Angel telecast. He says, you know what? You're in a visiting clubhouse, but you're on traveling with the team and you're celebrating a little bit too much in that dugout. You got to face these guys next time they come in town. And that was a good lesson to me. I didn't think I overdid it, but I needed to stay back a little bit as far as celebrations. And I'll never forget one time the Yankees were in town and I was sitting in my office and somebody for the A's hit a big comeback home run, the seventh or eighth inning for the A's to take a lead. And Don Mattingly, somehow the next inning, walked by and he says, hey, no high-fiving in there. And it was just myself and one of my assistants. But Mattingly happened to walk by at the time. The only couple times that I'd ever really thought about maybe celebrating too much. And you just had to suck it up, as every visiting clubhouse manager does in baseball, because they're employed by the home team.
Back to 1974 for just a second. As the visiting team clubhouse manager, you're in charge of the other team's equipment. So all the great hitters of the day, Brooks and Frank Robinson, Al Kaline, Carl Yastrzemski, you're in charge of taking care of their most prized possession when they leave for the day, their baseball bats.
You know what? Collecting wasn't a big thing there, so you didn't really have to worry about things like that disappearing.
Yeah.
And we were relatively safe in the Coliseum at the time, and it would have been hell to go through to try to get to the clubhouse and steal those things. So they weren't locked up that much or anything special. So like I said, collecting wasn't a big thing, where it became that way in the mid-80s, I guess, and there were more protective measures taken.
Were you starstruck by any of those guys?
Well, they're guys that I grew up, and of course, we didn't get many American League games except for the World Series on TV, and they'd only, Horace Stoneham from Giants, the owner, only let the Game of the Weeks come into the Bay Area in 67. So all those other years they had a Game of the Week, it was never televised into the Bay Area. So the only games we got on TV were the Dodger games, the 9 from Chavez Ravine, and then the All-Star game in the World Series. That was before the playoff format started. So I didn't know a lot of them. I knew a lot of their names and things and see them in World Series. But what's bigger than getting recommended for a job by Joe DiMaggio and spending every day at home for 2 years with Joe D?
In 74, there were some surly American League managers, Errol Weaver, Whitey Herzog, Ralph Houk, Billy Martin.
You know what? I got along with everybody. And of course, Billy and I had a good relationship because of his Oakland Oaks days. And my dad had me talk to Billy in 68 when he came back for a reunion of the Oakland Oaks and the San Francisco Seals, our first year in Oakland. So anyway, he was fine. There were a couple guys that weren't very personable and they were just in their own world. And that would be an Earl Weaver. Ralph Houk didn't open up a lot either, but nobody was tough to deal with at all. And they respect the job you have to do as I respect their job. So the funny thing is back then I was thinking the other night, Minnesota came in and their manager was Frank Quillacy, and he only had three coaches where every other club had four or five coaches. And today now they have 10 and 12, but only had three coaches and they didn't even have a hitting coach. They had a pitching coach and a first and third base coach, and that was it. Times have changed.
Yeah, they sure have. It was not out of the ordinary to receive some pretty unusual requests from visiting players. For instance, when the Red Sox were in town, can you tell me about what Carl Yastrzemski and Dwight Evans asked you to get them?
Yeah, they would come in with baseball then, and I think it reverts back to the days they traveled by train, but they would have these big, what we call steamer trunks, and these trunks were maybe 2 feet high and 3 feet deep and 5 feet across or 4 feet across, and they'd bring in a couple empty ones and have me fill it up with Coors beer, because at that time you couldn't get Coors east of the Mississippi, and I don't even think you get it to there. But anyway, they liked Coors beer, and it was a light beer. It was before the light beer phenomena came out in the mid to late 70s. So I would have to load up, and I'd go to this wholesale place, and they'd let me buy it at cost and bring it in and pack up the trunk, six packs here, six packs there, cases there, and fill up two trunks full of Coors beer. Well, the truth of the matter is Coors at the time was pasteurized and it needed to be refrigerated all the time. They were the only ones that delivered to local liquor stores, bars, and restaurants with a refrigerated truck. And that's what kind of made the beer unique. Well, by the time you put it in the trunk and it's not refrigerated, now you've got a 5 or 6 hour flight back to Boston after the series, and now they go to refrigerate it. It isn't the same anymore. Yeah. But they did that a few times, Yaz and Dwight Evans, and they seemed to still like it when they got it back to Boston, although it wasn't the same as when it was in Oakland.
After three world championships in the early 70s, the A's stumbled toward the end of the decade, so much so that in 79, the team lost 108 games, only drew 310,000 fans. They were nicknamed the Triple A's. Owner Charlie Fenley seriously considered moving the team to Denver, but instead hires Billy Martin as manager in 1980.
From the East Bay came news that caught the baseball world by surprise. Owner Charlie Fenley had hired Billy Martin to manage the Oakland A's.
Is it fair to say that Billy Ball saved the team in Oakland?
Absolutely. Carl Fenley was Charlie's cousin and longtime employee, kind of ran the business operations off and on for Charlie. And when Charlie couldn't move it to Denver that last year, that last winter, 79-80, we didn't have a manager until a week before spring training. Might have been even closer then. But Carl recommended Billy to Charlie. He says, you won't have to pay him much because the Yankees still have him under contract. You'll save money that way. And maybe he'll get some local people interested in not necessarily buying the club, but supporting the club in different ways, sponsorships, whatever. And so he hires Billy, and Billy takes over a young club. He's got a young Ricky Henderson, Dwayne Murphy, a few other young players. And we play over 500 ball. We draw 800,000 people, which is almost triple we had a year before. And it got the Haas family, the parent family of owners of Levi Strauss, based in San Francisco, interested in keeping the A's in Oakland, thinking it's good for the area and it's good for the community. And they buy the club from Charlie Fenley. And 1981 is the first ownership year of them. And saved the ball club for Oakland. It absolutely did.
The sudden flight of the Amazing A's was baseball's top story of 1980. One that started with the arrival of Billy the Kid, the American League's Manager of the Year.
In 1988, Steve, game one of the World Series between the A's and the Dodgers. During the game, you're actually in the Dodgers clubhouse at Dodger Stadium working on arrangements for both teams' trip back to Oakland for games 3, 4, and 5. And you see Kirk Gibson getting worked on.
As you look, you see Fernando Valenzuela, and you're looking for Kirk Gibson, and there is no Gibson.
You were down in the clubhouse?
Yes, and in a Dodger clubhouse, I went over to visit their people and find out who was on the traveling squad coming into Oakland. They'll come in on Monday morning and work out Monday night. And I knew Gibby well from Detroit. We had some fun together over the years. And he can hardly walk. I mean, he is in pain. And I'm thinking, no way is this guy going to play at all. And then I don't know if they shot him up with what or did they shoot him up with anything, but he comes to home plate and hits that home run that's so famous. It might have been the worst moment of my life.
High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
He still limped up to home plate, and he limped around the bases after he hit the home run. But to see him even get up to the plate after seeing what I saw in the clubhouse was amazing. It's just, and then to do what he did, and it was devastating for us.
Steve, you have such a deep personal connection to so much of baseball history. For one thing, thanks to you, there's always been a very tight fraternity amongst clubhouse managers, yourself, Frank Koppenbarger from the Phillies and Cardinals, the Kawano brothers from the Cubs and Dodgers, Mike Murphy, whose time with the Giants goes all the way back before 58 at Seal Stadium, Pete Sheehy from the Yankees. Take Pete, for instance. His clubhouse days go back to Babe Ruth. Do you remember any stories that that Pete shared with you over the years?
You know, Pete only traveled in Oakland a couple of times last couple of years that he was with the Yankees, because a lot of the equipment managers didn't travel in those days. But I would sit there and talk to Pete about his days and his favorite Yankee teams and Jody. And he mentioned Babe Ruth, but didn't really talk about him. But what I remember most about Pete, and I haven't seen him since he did this, but the night before the All-Star game, and Billy Crystal, who had never met Pete Sheehy, imitated him, and all he did it only from what how people told him how Pete walked, how Pete talked.
I've been watching rookies a lot of years, and I can pretty much tell who's going to make it and who ain't going to be up here long enough for the coffee to get cold. And every once in a while, some kid walks in here with something extra. Garrick had it, DiMaggio had it, Mickey had it. You know, these are the guys when they walk through the door over there, something special kind of just walks in with him, you know.
And it was dead on. And I haven't seen Billy Crystal since then. I had seen him before and got to know him a little bit. But he just imitated Pete Sheehy to the max. And it's a great piece. But I did get to meet Pete, and to be in his presence and the respect he commanded because of his longevity, it was cool to see, especially from the players.
The Coggins family in Baltimore, a family whose life revolved around baseball for 100 years. The Coggins family moved steamer trunks full of baseball equipment for the Orioles and then visiting teams going back to the 29th Street International League Oriole Park.
That's correct. He would talk about how it was his father-in-law who started that, or his father, and the trunks on horseback or carriage down to the train stations. And it's amazing that they've survived all those years and cared about it. But you know what? When you put personal care into it and you're reliable, clubs respect that too, and they'll hire you. So the Coggins family been around forever. And then the Tyler family from Baltimore. Freddie Tyler was running the visiting clubhouse. Jimmy Tyler was running the home clubhouse. And her dad did the umpire's room and was the ball boy to go all the way out. And his dad was up into his 80s and still running like a track star in and out. And 2 years ago, I had a picture taken of the two boys and myself and Mickey Morbido, our traveling secretary. And between us, we had 213 years in the major leagues.
Oh, my God.
Jimmy Tyler actually had a few more years than me, so.
Amazing. There were so many clubhouses from some of the great old ballparks that you traveled to. Tiger Stadium, Metropolitan Stadium, Cleveland Municipal Stadium, and the list goes on and on. Is there one of those clubhouses in particular that you could just feel the history in this place?
Well, you know, it was probably Detroit. I love Detroit. The stadium, the clubhouse was so small. And it was tough to work, and you just had to, you're stepping over people, over equipment, over chairs, everything. And, but being there for the 72 playoffs, we won the first two games in Oakland, went to Detroit. We had an off day. Campanaris had thrown the bat. We had threats. We were told not to go too far from the hotel downtown Detroit for our own safety. And, so we lose game three and we lose game four, and we had a 3-run lead in the top of the 10th. And Detroit scored three in the bottom, and the place went ballistic, and I had to sit there and myself and the equipment manager at the time had to defend the equipment in our dugout by swinging bats at people because they wanted to steal everything. They're going nuts because of the comeback. So now we go into game five, and we win game five, and that clubhouse is so small, but back then they didn't do anything on the field as far as celebrations. So he had to set up two stages, one for the interviewee and who's going to interview, and then one for the camera. And it just took up so much space. And then you've got, we win, we're going to our first World Series, we've got a short flight to Cincinnati to open it up in 2 days, and you've got Vida Blue giving the choke sign to Blue Moon Odom because Odom had thrown five innings but had came up with a dry heave. So the pressure was tremendous back then.
Yeah.
He came up with a dry heave, so Vida came in and threw four scoreless innings and gave Odom a choke hold, and now Odom's trying to climb over all this stuff to get at Vida Blue and have a fight, and it's like, we just won the playoffs. We're going to the World Series. We've got two of our own players trying to fight each other. And so that clubhouse always stands out for me. And it's sad to see the stadium get torn down, but they needed a new facility. A favorite stadium of mine was Yankee Stadium, even the old one.
Yeah, before the renovation.
Before the renovation, right. That I think 73 was the last year of that. Yeah, their favorite clubhouses, favorite memories, and some. Cleveland's was the smallest of all of them, their visiting clubhouse. But and Boston was pretty small, but Boston's a special place too at Fenway Park.
One more thing I do want to mention, after being part of the A's organization for parts of seven decades, you've seen so much change, particularly in player uniforms. I mean, I think back to 68 and 69, most of the players on those A's teams, I believe, wore size 34, 24 pants, 24 being the length.
Making That's pretty room. Good research. How'd you find that out?
Well, making room for those beautiful high socks and stirrups that you guys wore. And then your final season a couple of years ago, you probably had all kinds of variations, not just in pants, but belts and jerseys. How did you keep all that straight?
Well, fortunately, it was always a gradual change in the socks, the stirrups, how tight the players want them. Back in the day, you'd have the uniform company come in with the first few days of spring training, fit everybody, and then nothing fit right. And you'd have to bring in a tailor, usually to tighten the pants for the players. But nowadays, things are cut with precision of lasers and things, but there are more specifications, whether it be a half inch on a waist or you want no elastic at the bottom of the pants. You want it to be able to flare out a little bit. So there were a lot of changes. The biggest change being just more uniform possibilities. I know a few years ago, the Diamondbacks here in Phoenix had 8 or 9 different uniforms. How do you keep up with that? And every time you call up a new player or make a trade, you've got to make up maybe 18 jerseys then. So the change in uniforms, you mentioned the belts. There's custom belts now, and they're different colors. And for a while in the 70s, when you look at us, we didn't even wear belts because we had the drawstrings inside because you had the same ribbing around the top of the pants as you do around the sleeves. So there's been a lot of changes in bats, maple being the predominant wood these days, and Major League Baseball had to go ahead and try to figure out a way to keep the maple bats from exploding. Those are the ones that are like 15 years ago you just saw going all over the diamond, and they've done a pretty good job with that. So that's changed, and the helmets have changed now, and there's been a lot of change, but fortunately, like I said, it was a gradual change over time.
Hey, listen, Steve, thanks so much for the time. It's so much fun hearing your stories going back. How many years did it end up? 54. Well, really, if you think about, because you were at spring training, they're really 55 parts.
I started the 55th season, correct?
Right. Parts of seven different decades.
Well, thank you. It was fun. I was in the right place at the right time. And my dad always told me, don't do anything you can get fired for. So that's why I think I lasted.
Steve, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you. All the best.
Anytime you need me, give me a call.
Honestly, we need to have Steve back on another episode down the road. He spent 54 plus years with the A's, so there's only so much that I can get to in a half an hour. But we didn't even get to touch on the 80s, those 80s teams with Ricky Henderson, McGuire, Canseco, Eckersley, Carney, Lansford. That 89 World Series by itself, that could be an episode. So much change that happened during the A's first 54 years in Oakland. The one constant in that A's clubhouse was Steve Vucinich. And I certainly enjoy every conversation that I have with former players and broadcasters, but there is always something special about spending a few minutes with a clubhouse manager or a bat boy. They never disappoint. And Vuce certainly didn't today. Special thanks to former Cardinals and Phillies clubhouse manager Frank Koppenbarger for helping to make this one happen. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate you, man. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by Xavier Guerra, Alex Kemp, Curtis Litzenberger, John Carter, John McBride, Kyle Schmidt, Manny Zavlakis, Mike Dunn, Mike Lipinski, and Ryan Beard. Looking forward to being back with you again on the first Wednesday of next month for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.